I have a lot of opinions about some of the cabal of dramaturgy that happens in this country. And I do think that it's important to blow apart a process or to singularize a process, right? Writers are, as you're likely very aware, I mean, are wildly idiosyncratic creatures. And I think that a process has to be wildly idiosyncratic in response, right?
That's Gil Garrett, the artistic director of the Blythe Festival. The Blythe Festival was founded in 1975 by James Roy, who was born in the town of Blythe and a graduate of the York University Theater Program. The festival is about a 45-minute drive from the Stratford Festival, 2-hour drive from Toronto, so if you're thinking of going to see some theater in southwestern Ontario, make sure you include the Blythe Festival on your list of things to do. The season opens June 28th, and we're going to get into the season in my interview with Gil Garrett today. Hey, thanks so much for joining me. By the way, I'm Keith Tomasek. You're listening to The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it, brought to you by StratfordFestivalReviews.com. Great interview today with Gil Garrett, as I mentioned. And just as some background, in the podcast, Gil talks about the first time he auditioned for the Blythe Festival after graduating from the National Theatre School. And just as some background, he auditioned for Paul Thompson. He tells that story. Paul Thompson was named the Officer of the Order of Canada for his contributions to Canadian theatre, particularly for bringing the stories of ordinary Canadians to the stage and for bringing theatre to rural communities. Thompson was also awarded a Governor General's Performing Arts Award for a lifetime artistic achievement. Yeah, I just wanted to give you that background on Paul Thompson, because like many of some of the greats in Canadian theatre, he has worked and continues to be involved with the Blythe Festival. Before we get to the interview, if you enjoy my conversations about the performing arts, please visit my website, theinadequatelife.com, and there's a little tab there called Support the Show. Now, I used to be a street performer in old Montreal, and I'd always ask people to, you know, throw a little something in the hat. Well, the Support the Show tab on theinadequatelife.com is like that, except it's a digital hat, so you can just throw in some digital change. You can leave a $5 donation, whatever you like. If you do throw in $30 in the digital hat, I'll send you some delicious tea from Karen Hartwick over at Stratford Tea Leaves. I'm drinking some right now. It's the Yashador Darjeeling. So a $30 donation and you get some free tea in the mail. Thanks to Anna Gall in Montreal, my hometown. Anna supported the show with her digital donation. And Anna, your tea is in the mail. As I mentioned, the Blythe Festival kicks off June 28th. Here's my interview with artistic director Gil Garrett.
We're going to talk about all kinds of things for the upcoming season at the Blythe Festival. We'll talk about some of the work you did in the past. But I just want to start out by talking about your shift from being an actor, a writer, to an administrator. You're the artistic director at the Blythe Festival. So, and when you came in your first season, on the very first day, you doubled ticket sales and had, after that, critically acclaimed season. So congratulations on all that.
Thank you.
But how did it feel to decide to make that step to become one of the guys in the office?
I mean, the board called me, and at the time, I immediately had this visceral reaction of a kind of responsibility, of actually feeling like I'd been involved with the company since 1999. I mean, I did 13 consecutive seasons as a performer, a writer, a director, and then I really did feel like there were, it's beyond a kind of roots or beyond a sense of family to, and I don't want to, I might point to the word like obligation, but not in the terms of feeling any way beholden, but sure, more so feeling that there, especially with the Blythe Festival, there is a real sense of mission there, right? And I feel profoundly that that theater serves a truly pure purpose, and being a part of that is huge, right?
Yeah. And you're right, the mission is super. I mean, to me as an outsider, seems very clear. Let's develop Canadian new works about rural life. Is that pretty much
absolutely
fair?
Yeah. And it's also about developing that audience too, like, which is an interesting thing. Like one of the when I first went to Blythe, so I went there, I mean, I was 20 years old. I did my very first season.
Coming out of where? Were you an urban kid or an agricultural?
I grew up in Toronto, and it was Paul Thompson who saw me in a show at Buddies in Bad Times, who ended up getting in touch with me, calling me and inviting me to come out. Actually inviting me, first of all, to come and audition for him. He asked me to meet him for coffee at the Epicure Cafe in Toronto, which at the time was a very popular kind of theater cafe. And I remember sitting outside on the porch waiting for him, or on the patio waiting for him. And he pulled up in this thoroughly abused beige pickup truck, and he had his 10-speed, you know, in the back, and a whole bunch of farm tools back of this truck. And I thought we were going to sit and have a coffee, and he just said, "You don't get in the truck." So then I got in the truck, and we drove way out to this warehouse where he had some friend who had this warehouse. And he opens up the warehouse, and we go inside, and it's just the two of us. And he lays out all of these pitchforks and shovels, and has me help him unload the truck.
And have you met him ever?
At this point, I never met him. At this point, I had never laid eyes on him. And he then says to me, "Okay, I want you to work, and I want it to be interesting." And then he just sat on a stool, and I set about trying to make it work. And then. And the other thing he did was he said, "I want you to channel Rodin."
Oh my gosh.
So this was what I was kind of attempting to do.
So you're in a barn kind of setting with tools with a strange man on a stool. Do
channeling
some work,
Rodin.
Make it interesting and channel Rodin.
Yeah. So Paul invited me to come out to, after this audition, he had invited me to come out to Blythe and do this show called Death of the Hired Man, which was my very first experience out there. And it was one of these shows, kind of the legendary Blythe, or legendary, you know, atypical Blythe show, where it was set on a farm. We went out there, and all the actors spent like the first 2 weeks actually working on a Mennonite farm, so we could be actually, you know, clearing the sheaves of wheat and loading them into the thrashing machine and getting this whole thing, because that show took place inside a barn with a thrashing machine at harvest time, and we were playing out that drama. But the audience was so hungry. They loved that show so much. People filled that theater. They were so vocal during the show, right? Like people talking back to what was happening on stage. And then on top of that too, there is a proprietorship that the audience in Blythe feels that I think is truly inspiring. So they, you know, they'll stop you in the grocery store and tell you exactly what they think of the show. And it may not be positive.
Right. Well, that's right? Cool, though.
They won't hesitate to let you know that. It's an amazing thing. It radically shifted my perspective on my role as an artist, for sure. I think before that point, I mean, and I was really young too, but before that point, I really believed that my role as an artist was to express myself, and that the role of the audience was to indulge that expression. And that was sort of the gig. And I think that when I went out there and had that experience, I suddenly went, whoa, son, it's not about you. It's not about you. It's entirely about them. And that was a massive education.
But now, you're an administrator, and you have a responsibility not only of honoring that commitment to the audience, but you have to get bums in seats. That's part of your job now.
Yeah.
How do you balance those two things? And you've had success, so congrats. It's been good.
Part of that, again, is about continuing to deepen that relationship. Like, I can say, I mean, like, in the minutiae of things, in tiny detail, like, there are no thank you letters or receipts for donations that leave the theater without me seeing them.
What's the biggest mistake you made in that process, or thing you learned in that process?
Whoa.
Because you're knocking on doors to get millions of dollars, right?
Yeah, we're knocking on doors to get millions of dollars. I think there is always blood on the floor. And I think that it's hard to... we have to always be aware of that, too. There's always blood on the floor. And I think that that's a reality in any arts institution, anywhere across the country.
But you're in such a small community. How do you heal those wounds, right?
Yeah. And I think that...
it's not like you can go... There's only so many sources for the money.
Yeah, for sure. That's absolutely true. I think of respect and listening.
Yeah.
And that's a big, big part of it, right? Is making sure that people feel heard. There are routinely egos that are slamming into each other all over the place, and finding ways to make sure that people are able to have their rant and their rage and still be able to pull in the same direction, right? It's a constant, it's really hard, but I think for myself, one thing that I've made a real point of is trying to call people who I love and respect and who I know are, who have walked these wires long before me. So I've made a point of calling Anthony Cimolino. I've made a point of calling Jillian Kiley. I've made a point of calling these people throughout, whenever I feel like I'm in a corner, to get a shift of perspective. And they've been hugely instructive.
And that's really an important thing, I think, for anyone to appreciate. So you're calling some of the leaders in the industry when you're in your worst. You're not calling them when you're doing great. Hey, no, it's like, okay, I'm in a corner. Yeah. I don't know what the F to do.
Yeah.
Please help.
Please help me. Please help me. Yeah. And it's interesting, too, like how often, more than anything, what I have found bolstering, interestingly, is when I am in those corners and I do reach out like that, how often the relief actually comes from those people saying, you know what, like either I've been in that corner or here's the corner I'm in right now. And then have that moment of recognition of, oh, right. There are always these kinds of obstacles that we get snagged on. That's a huge relief, right?
Yeah. And that's part of why I'm doing the podcast, so people can understand, because there's people all over Canada. They might not be able to call the Stratford Festival, or they might not be able to call the National Arts Centre where Jillian is now, but they might be calling you after this podcast.
There you go.
Wow, so that's great that you're helping bring people up at the same time as looking to people that have been there before you. Earlier, you talked about a new play development. So anyone who's listening who is interested in working as a writer and developing a voice, and talk a bit about your role in that process at Blythe.
I would say one thing I've really tried to be very conscious of, as we develop shows at Blythe, is making sure that, I have a lot of opinions about some of the cabal of dramaturgy that happens in this country.
Oh, nice.
And, I do think that, it's important to blow apart a process or to singularize a process, right? Writers are, as you're likely very aware, I mean, are wildly idiosyncratic creatures. And I think that a process has to be wildly idiosyncratic in response, right? I also profoundly believe that a huge part of play development is committing to production. So that writer knows that work is going to be in front of an audience, and that they have a sense of who that audience is and what that community is. There are so many plays in this country that languish in workshop after workshop after workshop until they reach some kind of distilled, you know, elixir that they've reached finally that point that you can, it's ridiculous. I talk a little bit about the Blythe audience, and in the same way, I think the Blythe audience is engaged in that evolution of those plays, right? The way that they grow.
That's interesting. And I think the audience feels that responsibility there, because they recognize it's a really special time. This is the first time this play has gone on stage. The person's been workshopped through the process.
At Blythe, the previews are a raucous time. And the people who come out to those previews, there's a lot of diehards who are part of our audience who, that's what they want. They want to come to the previews. They want to come when there is the possibility of the greatest number of possible mistakes. Or they want to come when things are still changing and still in flux. They want to be a part of that moment. When my predecessor, Eric Coates, used to call the previews the hard hat dress rehearsal.
And again, these are, so the Blythe is 1,000 people. These are people from smaller towns within a 30-minute drive away.
Yeah. who are driving in for that one thing. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And every year, how many original plays every year?
Oh, we don't necessarily have a quota. Oh,
okay.
But more years than not, they're all new.
And was the Birds and the Bees last year?
Yeah, Mark Birds Crawford? And Bees was last year, yeah.
And was that developed through you guys?
That was developed through us, yeah.
Oh, yeah, cool. So I saw Mark at the Groundlings, and he is, and I didn't get to see the Birds and the Bees, but he, on stage doing Shakespeare, he brought so much comedy and levity to the production of Shakespeare. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't go see the Birds and the Bees, because I would have loved to seen, because obviously he knows what he's doing in terms of humor and comedy.
Yeah, Mark is hilarious. He has a profound love of watching an audience laugh. I mean, and yet in no way cheapening it, right? Like in no way letting it be facile or empty. It's laughter that is hugely valuable. It's really quite thrilling.
And talk about your process in developing that play, that piece of work.
Yeah, so Mark wrote a show for Blythe in 2014. He didn't actually write it for Blythe. He'd been working on it for a while. But it was a piece called Stag and Doe. And Stag and Doe had great traction in Blythe, and audiences really responded to it. And when I took over as the AD, one of my very, very first phone calls was to Mark and to say, like, what do you want to work on next? Where do you want to go? What is the next idea? And at that point, he had impulses for Birds and the Bees, but it was all that he wanted to do a show that was somehow about neonicotinoids and their impact on the bee population. And he also wanted to do it on, he'd been reading about how turkeys can no longer have sex, and that all turkey breeding happens through artificial insemination. And at the same time, he wanted it to be about, he had this vision of a farm wife whose husband has run off with the wife from across the road, and that the two of them are left there, and that they somehow decide that they're going to have, they can't stand each other. They get awful lonely on Friday nights, and they're going to create some kind of a sexual relationship that they can have outside of having to actually tolerate each other's presence. And so he wanted to put all of these things, all these elements together.
I got to back up.
Yeah, go.
Because in Toronto, she's just going to go on Tinder.
Well, this is it, right?
But in the farm, you can't do that.
It's a lot harder.
It's a lot harder.
Yeah, yeah.
That's hilarious. You really
have to, yeah, you keep expanding, you know, your radius.
Oh, my God. All right. So Mark, he
came to me with these ideas.
Oh, that's easy. I can see that. Sure.
And then I said, like, okay,
where do you go with that?
Where do we go with that? Where do we? And he just started down that road of writing that piece. And then as it grew,
and then what's the first thing he hands you?
The first thing that he handed me was he sent me like about a half page of that idea, sort of like in an email. Just kind of went, these are the things I'm attracted to, these ideas, and what do you think? And then from there we, Blythe got him some money and committed to developing the work, and then we kept pushing it and growing it from there. And then there were a couple.
What was the second thing he gave you?
Second thing he gave me was Mark works from, and this is not something that I expect from every writer.
But this is your idiosyncratic process, which I love.
Idiosyncratic process.
Different depending on the author.
So Mark likes to work from an outline. So the next thing that Mark sent me was basically an outline of the scenes that he saw, what would have to happen.
In chronological order.
Yeah. It's very particular to, again, to Mark. Like, I know with Mark that the first draft, structurally, is going to profoundly resemble what will hit the stage.
How long after the structure is established to the first table read, and then what after the table read?
So with Birds and the Bees, we did two table reads.
With an audience, because it's comedy.
We read some scenes in front of audience, probably like into the third draft of it.
Okay.
But it wasn't really till that point.
And then after the table read, anything fall horribly flat? Were you going, oh, this ain't working?
No, but Mark is pretty astute at seeing like what hasn't functioned and what has.
Yeah.
And then there were several things that that I pushed for, and performers. The performers who we were bringing in, all of them had a ton of experience with new plays, and so they were also asking some pretty astute questions and trying to get to the bottom of some stuff. And
wow! Any tension at all in the process, or was it all?
Oh, plenty.
What was the most tense thing?
Well, you know, it's that I've said this before too, but
plenty.
I think that comedy I have witnessed in the rehearsal of comedy more relationships destroyed, like friendships obliterated over the course of comedy than I ever have working in tragedy. It's just the case. I think that there's something about comedy requires, the sense of timing is such a grill to fry on. I mean, it's interesting. There's a great Ionesco quote. There's a TVO doc about Ionesco when he was visiting Toronto for something, and he's being interviewed. I think they were doing a production of Bald Soprano in Montreal at the time, and they ask him about what he thinks of Toronto. And he says that Toronto is a city of dogs. Everyone is constantly running around sniffing each other's asses and trying to bury their bones. And that and he says, but Montreal is a city like Athens, where everyone are cats and they're all just looking for somewhere to lay and look at each other.
That's beautiful.
That's really beautiful. And but he talks about comedy and tragedy in this thing. And what he says is that he throws this contrary position that I find quite amazing, as he says that tragedy is the theater of optimists, that it is the optimist who believes in who adheres to tragedy, because the only reason that it's tragic is because you believe the world should turn out differently, right? So when Hamlet dies, the tragedy of Hamlet's death is that he should become the king. He should be vindicated. It should turn out a different way.
And it didn't, therefore I'm moved.
Therefore I'm moved, because my deep sense of hope of the way the world should be has been violated. And that it actually reinforces the optimist's view. Whereas he argues comedy is the theater of pessimists, because it actually proposes that anything could happen.
And the laughter is the recognition of the pathetic nature of whatever it is. And you just saw it. This is... That's really now it's all about me now, because I love tragedy. Ask my friends. I love it. I love a good tragedy, but it's so hard to find a good tragedy. I find that so often the tragedies aren't even tragic enough, or they're not deep enough for me. But I do love comedy too. Like, that's one of the things I'm excited about at the Stratford Festival this year, is seeing Chris Abraham direct Tartuffe.
Oh yeah,
because one of the best things I thought he ever did was The Matchmaker, which was so funny. Like, I loved that. I just laughed so hard. That's interesting. Now, did you end up directing Mark's work as well?
I didn't direct
okay,
it.
Okay, no. So the tension was that you witness
right. That comedy does put people in those positions.
And was it more between the director and the actors and the actors? Where was that? Am I getting too personal now?
It's slightly telling tales out of school, but I think it ends up becoming like actors to actors, actors to directors, actors to writers. You're even more naked on stage when you're doing comedy.
Just going to take a quick little break for a word from my sponsors. Of course, first and foremost, Karen Hartwick over at StratfordTeaLeaves.com. I was in Stratford the other day, dropped by, and she gave me this wonderful Yeshadora Darjeeling, a beautiful Darjeeling that I'm drinking. And I said to her, I woke up with a headache that morning, and she actually took me through some Kui Jung exercises that she's been learning about. She's actually a medical Kui Jung trainer. I can tell you, every time I go in there, something cool happens. You meet great people. So if you're in Stratford, book a tea tasting. She does honey and tea, chocolate and tea. You can book a tea tasting or just drop in to experience the world's best, freshest, and most exotic loose leaf teas with Karen Hartwick. She's Canada's tea sommelier. And my other sponsor, Daylight, the productivity app exclusively for Mac, iPhones, and iPads. Daylight's used by musicians, composers, as well as music and creative agencies. It helps you organize and keep track of all the business stuff. So as an entrepreneur or a creative team, you have more time and energy to focus on your creative work. You know what I'm talking about. All that business stuff. It's hard to be in the creative mindset when you're trying to keep track of your schedule, who you need to follow up with, invoicing, what do you have to do next Tuesday? Daylight does all that for you. It organizes your contacts, your emails, your tasks, your appointments, your schedule, all in one app. You don't have to remember who to follow up with and when, because Daylight does that for you. And with Daylight, all your business info is organized, searchable, and shared with your team. Creative entrepreneurs all over the world use Daylight to grow their business and improve efficiency. Visit marketcircle.com/daylight to start a 30-day free trial of Daylight. That's marketcircle.com/daylight. And don't forget to mention you heard about it through The Inadequate Life to get 50% off your first month subscription. Now back to my podcast with Gil Garrett at the Blythe Festival.
Now, have you got any comedies this year coming up, or did you, no comedies now?
More comedies. No, there's a whack of comedies. So the Berlin Blues, which is Drew Hayden Taylor's play, it's not a new play, but it's a hilarious comedy that Drew wrote. And the basic premise, I actually worked on the very first draft of it about 13 years ago at Lighthouse Theater. And the play is about a fictional reserve called Otter Lake, and these two German developers who show up, and they have $164 million, which they are offering to the community. And then what they want to do is build a native themed amusement park with bumper canoes and the International Longhouse of Pancakes and a giant laser dream catcher. And like, I mean, it's horrible. It's very, very funny. And half the community gets on board. And
of course,
don't, right?
Of course.
There's a brilliant character in it called Trailer, who lives on the reserve, grew up on the reserve. His family, they've been living multi-generationally in the same trailer, which he refers to as a family heirloom. And he ends up actually getting on board with the Germans and convinces them that he actually plays bass in a country band. And he convinces them that he is a music producer. And so they hire him to create the Grandstand show, which is going to be Dances with Wolves, the musical.
Okay.
It's incredible.
I just love it that the Germans are the bad guys. Like, yeah. That's so old school.
Well, this is a fascinating thing. Drew has done a ton of work overseas as a writer in residence all over universities in Germany, done a bunch of lecture tours over there. And there's this bizarre thing in Germany where there was a writer named Carl May who wrote a series of romances really called the Winnetou books. And they were, Carl May had never been to North America, but they were total fictional, like cowboys and Indians.
That was
the whole thing. Yeah. And to this day, they are massively influential and hugely successful. And there are even outdoor, like there are three outdoor venues, these massive amphitheaters in Germany to this day that have great big giant outdoor shows based on the Winnetou series that actually have like German, like white, like Aryan German actors in leather and feathers, like playing First Nations heroes, getting into fights. And there's one, Drew was telling me about it. He went to go and see it. They even had a trained eagle that would like fly
land on a guy's arm.
Yeah. Just ridiculous.
Okay. And I'm going to wrap up. We'll talk about the other play. So that's in July. But the thing about that, I noticed it's directed, because I saw Brad Fraser. I thought, but Brad's doing a comedy. Is he known for that, or am I missing something? Brad Fraser, Unidentified Human Remains and The True Nature of Love. That's the big, big, big show that everyone will know.
Brad Superman. And I mean, Brad is very funny. He also has done a ton of, there's something about the Berlin Blues, first of all, in the way that it's presented, it's quite stylized, right? Okay. So it has a sense of, there's almost a sitcom-like quality to it.
Yeah.
There were so many reasons to bring Brad on board with that project. I also really wanted to bring a provocateur onto
Right?
I mean, and Brad has been massively provocative all across the country with all kinds of his work.
Now, you think there was tension with Mark Crawford's The Virgin of Bees. Wait till this thing gets up. That's going to be fun.
Quite a thing.
And how do you not offend people? But I will just wait till that comes, because you got the native folks, you got the Germans. Okay. Let's go to the first show. This sounds much less offensive to anybody. Mr. New Year's Eve, A Night with Guy Lombardo. Of course, Guy, a native from London, Ontario, born here and changed. People don't even understand this about Guy Lombardo. Like, he changed technology, his use of recording music. Like, it's not just about the New Year's Eve song. He was actually one of the early guys, like sort of in the Mold of Houdini, who became a celebrity back in those days. Like,
oh yeah, pretty it's cool. Massive. Guy. I'm not actually convinced that there is any other Canadian musician that has ever achieved the kind of celebrity that Guy Lombardo did in his lifetime.
That has lasted, endured. Yeah, yeah, no way. Sure.
I mean, from 1929 to 1974, he was the go-to band leader for, you know, New Year's Eve celebrations all across North America.
One of the first guys. The world, right? One of the first guys to do live radio.
Live radio, live television. Yeah. I mean, it was a massive, massive thing, and incredibly, I mean, one of the things that for me positions him so uniquely at Blythe too is, for one thing, when the band was first starting out, they were cutting their teeth in Huron County in Grand Bend. That was where they were, you know, laying down their first sense of how to be a band, how to play for an audience.
Wow.
So they were playing that grandstand, and then on top of that, well into the 60s and the 70s, when these guys were massive international successes. I mean, making more money than they could possibly spend their lifetime, more fame. Like, they sold over 300 million records, right? These guys were still touring to Town Hall in Seaforth. They were still touring to the Bayfield Town Hall.
Sure,
they were still playing these tiny towns and tiny venues, I think out of a deep sense of knowing who their roots were, knowing who they were, who that sense of loyalty to that community,
yeah,
it never faded. And I find that extraordinary.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. So that's opening the season. And then August, now we're into August, the Pigeon King, which I know nothing about.
Oh, no? You don't know the Pigeon King story? Oh, no. Man. This is a really incredible story. It's unbelievable. There is a brilliant primer. There was a New York Times article about the Pigeon King that came out maybe 2 years ago. So in 2001, so there was a man named Arlen Galbraith who was a decorated exotic bird breeder, pigeon breeder. He had been, you know, the chair of the Fur Fancier Society, a bunch of things.
Sure.
And Arlen shows up at a neighbor's door in 2001 and he says, listen, I need some help. Here's the thing. I've got a contract with the Saudi royal family to breed their racing pigeons. And he had developed his own breed, which were called Strathclyde Genetics. And he said, I don't have the capacity in my barn to be able to breed enough of these birds. Can we make a deal? So I will sell you, breeding pairs for $100 a pop. And then I will commit to buying back all of the offspring, $25 a piece. And they can have like 13 chicks in a year.
Huh.
So you could conceivably make your money back and more within a year. And, can we do this?
Sure.
So they make a deal. And over the course of the next 7 years, he builds a $43 million Ponzi scheme entirely built on pigeons. There is no end market. These pigeons are just getting bought and sold as breeders again and again and again. The thing went international. It was happening across the states. There's over 1,000 farmers that were taken in this.
Oh my God.
Huge swaths of the Mennonite and the Amish community, which was one of the places where he focused his attention. But they, he got busted, finally went bankrupt in 2008. And they, I mean, there were people who were by 2008, there were people who were investing. There was a Hutterite colony in Alberta who invested at $1 million as a starting investment into this thing. But he went up, he was put up on charges and convicted in court in Waterloo and went to prison.
Wow.
And he just got paroled this past summer.
Oh, well, he'll be there. Yeah. Opening night.
Yeah, so
that's so bizarre.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. And people got burned. Like, there are people who had Century Farms who sold their Century Farms to be able to invest deeper and deeper.
That's fast. And I don't think that would happen today because people, I mean, my guess is, I don't know, did the Saudis actually race pigeons? I've spent some time in the Middle East. I know falcons are huge, but pigeons.
But he also shifted the story as it went along. So it started out with the Saudi thing, and it later went on that he was creating, he was getting into squab meat market.
Of course, yeah.
All this
kind
of stuff,
yeah.
And just built and built and built and built till he had this massive.
Wow.
Yeah. It's an incredible story.
And then you're closing with a world premiere of a show, Ipperwash.
Yeah.
That's the closest reserve to Blythe, isn't it? Right?
Yeah, Kettle and Stony Point. Yeah. Okay. So this piece is being written by Phelan Johnson and Jessica Carmichael. And they've been working on it for, I think we're looking at about 2 years. And they've been going into the community at Kettle and Stony Point and getting to develop some relationships there and interviewing people who live there in the community. And the big focus of that piece is really on what became Camp Ipperwash. So in 1942, the Canadian government actually expropriated a 4,000 acre tract of land.
So this is during the war?
This is during the war. This is near the end of the war, actually. And when they, so they expropriated this piece of land to turn it into a training base. And there were already, even predating that, there were a number of land thefts and land claims. There were a bunch of pretty, pretty diabolical, end runs over the Indian agent at the time and land was taken. But the Ipperwash, where they created Camp Ipperwash, incredibly enough, there were actually soldiers from the community who were serving overseas at the time that their homes were expropriated and bulldozed to build this camp. And it had an unbelievably devastating effect. So not only did those people lose their homes, but one of the things that they did was on the neighboring reserve, so there's Kettle and Stony Point, the people were actually moved and then land was subdivided. And so people who were in the neighboring reserve had their land cut in half so that they could accommodate
settle the people,
these people who had been uprooted. Unbelievably, you know, a lot of these servicemen and women came home to discover that this land had been taken from them, right? And that their families had been moved.
By the country that they're serving.
By the country that they were serving.
Without any kind of notice. So,
and that's the thing, right? And not only that. So then in the story, unbelievably, and it's one of these chapters of Canadian history that is just profoundly dark and one that I think that we have to embrace and consider and think about, especially if we are genuinely going to try to enter this era of reconciliation, this age of reconciliation that we talk about. I mean, it's going to require a profound relationship to honesty. So what ended up happening when people came home, the war was over and the deal had been the land was going to be handed back and it didn't get handed back. And so there have been decades and decades of legal battle. The most infamous part of that was a protest that was that happened in 1995, where the OPP shot and killed a protester named Dudley George, who was there unarmed. He actually horribly bled out in the back seat of his brother's car in the emergency ward. In the, like the turnabout where you pull in to get into the emergency ward. So they had been chased by the police from the protest with his brother bleeding in the back. And he actually, they took the time to arrest his brother at the emergency ward rather than running Dudley into the hospital. But on the other side of that, this past year, just under a year ago in April, 2016, they finally did reach a settlement with the feds. And the land has been given back. So that land has finally been given back. And there's actually a $94, $96 million settlement that's been part of that as well. And it has offered a ray of hope to the community. At the same time, incredibly, there are now families who have moved back into Camp Ipperwash and who are living in those barracks. But unbelievably, the Department of Defense is still there. And why is the Department of Defense still there? They're still there because they don't know where all of the munitions are. And so there are still live explosives all over that site. And there are actually signs. There's little signs up on like the telephone poles that say, if you see something that looks like this, don't touch it, call the DOD at this number. And you actually have families, children,
kids,
elderly people who are all back living in that community. There's an amazing woman who Phelan and Jessica got to meet just this past winter, who, incredibly enough, was married to a man who was overseas serving when they lost their home. She lost her home and is now, I'm pretty sure, I think she's 90 years old, but she's now living back in the barracks. So there's just an amazing arc of stories there.
Yeah, yeah, I'm assuming that's a tragedy.
yeah, I mean, interesting. I don't even know how to frame it, right? Like, I think we are trying to find as much hope in it as we can.
Yeah. And so three premieres. So the Mr. New Year's Eve, a world premiere, Pigeon King, a world premiere, and then Ipperwash, a world premiere. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, you got a lot of work ahead of you.
Still I got a lot of work ahead of me. That's true. It's true.
Thanks so much, Gil, for doing this. I really appreciate it.
I hugely appreciate the time. Thank you.
I'll get out there for sure and invite folks to get on the 401 and then get up. What's the exit they take to get up? When you come from Toronto, what do you do?
Definitely Highway 8.
Okay.
The easiest way is to go 401 to Highway 8 to Highway 4, and then you can't miss it.
That's so easy.
401. The theater is right on 4. 401 to 8 to 4.
That's so easy. Cool. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. Gil Garrett at the Blythe Festival. So much fun to talk to Gil. We talked a lot about raising kids, actually. I wasn't able to get that in the podcast. I wanted to keep it short, but wow, his kids have so much fun up there every summer. Just free range kids, I wish, eh? Be sure to check out the entire season at blythefestival.com. That's B-L-Y-T-H festival.com. Also, while you're checking out the website, be sure to click on the events and look at the country suppers. Those are really good suppers presented by some of the local churches, the Legion, and of course, the Legion Ladies Auxiliary. That's at blythefestival.com events. We talked about Mark Crawford, his play, The Birds and the Bees. That's running this summer at the Victoria Playhouse Petrolia. That's in Petrolia, Ontario, from May 30th to June 17th. Lots of fun, The Birds and the Bees. Petrolia is, what is it? Southwest of Blythe, another beautiful old theater that's just doing great these days. I'll have links to all of that on my website, theinadequatelife.com. Don't miss an episode. Just subscribe on iTunes. It's super easy. Search the iTunes store for The Inadequate Life and then hit subscribe. If you're on an iPhone, you should have a podcast app. Just click on that and look for The Inadequate Life. That way you'll never miss an episode like the one featuring my interview with Irene Sankoff and David Hine, the creators of Come From Away. If you're a creative person, you have to hear the story behind that show. That's The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. I'm Keith Tomasek. Thanks for listening.